right, welcome back. At 9 o'clock, it's Got Science. Talks about fighting forest fires in Alaska and the killer heat that's sweeping America. And don't forget, all of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kb.fm or use your mobile app and click on donate. Hope you all are having a great day. This is Claire Rosado. It's a rainy day, but hopefully you all are setting up for a great weekend. All right, coming up soon, Got Science. We're going to talk a lot about fighting forest fires in Alaska and the killer heat that's sweeping America.
Welcome to the Got Science Podcast. I'm your host, Colleen McDonald. Well, summer is still here, and it's still stinking hot, even in Alaska, and that's what we're diving into today. Stick around after the interview. Shreya Dervasula has another egregious example of how the Trump administration is sidelining science. This July has felt like one heat wave after another, and we're certainly not spared here in Boston. If you listened to our last episode, you know that extreme heat will endanger more and more people in the coming years. But today we're going to the unpopulated forests in Alaska, where rising temperatures pose a threat to us all, even those of us not directly in harm's way. Alaska sweltered on the 4th of July this year. The trees turned dry, the soil got hot, and forests across the state were primed for the wildfires that followed. You might not hear about these wildfires in the news because they usually hit regions where nobody lives, which makes fighting these fires less of a priority. But as our guest today tells us, we should start paying more attention to these flames because they're part of a bigger, vicious cycle, one that exacerbates climate change and sets up the forest for even more wildfires. I spoke to my colleague, Dr. Carly Phillips, a Kendall Science Fellow in the Climate and Energy Program here at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Her research focuses on protecting carbon in the forests far north, and specifically, what happens when wildfires and heat waves sweep through iconic Alaskan landscapes. She takes me on a tour down into the forest's soil. Yes, more geeking out on soil. And explains what permafrost is, how it connects back to the wildfires, and why it plays such a critical role in climate change. More importantly, she shares how we can use a technology we already have to break this cycle. And most importantly, she shares which Beyoncé songs, when not sung by Beyoncé, are the most effective for scaring off grizzly bears. Carly, welcome to the Got Science Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you study boreal forests with a focus on preserving carbon in the boreal forest, specifically in Alaska. So can you start by giving us the definition of a boreal forest?
Yeah, so boreal forests are the forests that occur at the highest latitudes, so the most northern forests that we have. They are below Arctic tundra, which typically when we think of Arctic tundra, we're thinking of, you know, small plants, shrubs. But when we move into the boreal forest, we have trees, conifers, pines, that sort of thing. But the thing that unites both of those ecosystems, both tundra and boreal forest, is that both of those are underlain by permafrost, which stores a huge amount of carbon.
So permafrost is it's frozen soil, is that what permafrost is?
Yeah, it's a mix of soil, rocks, and ice. So basically, if you think of a soil matrix that you dumped water on and completely soaked and then stuck in the freezer, that's kind of the gist of permafrost. So it has this ice and water component, and in some places these ice wedges, but yes, mostly soil.
In the warmer seasons, does it melt or is it supposed to stay frozen all the time?
For permafrost, the standard definition is that it has to be frozen for at least 2 years. So you have continuous permafrost and discontinuous permafrost. And continuous is what it sounds like, where it's all permafrost all the time, essentially. And then in discontinuous areas, you have areas of continuous permafrost that are frozen year-round with patches that may thaw out depending on the season. But in all permafrost areas, typically you have a small portion, perhaps a foot or two, that are going to thaw out every summer, and that's the active layer. And one of the things that we've seen with climate warming is that that active layer is thickening every year.
How thick is it?
It can be anything from a few meters thick to, 2,000 feet.
Does the permafrost, with the changing of seasons, does the top part of it melt? Is it supposed to melt?
Yeah, definitely. So there's a specific part, maybe 2 or 3 feet or so, that thawed every summer, and that's the active layer. The active layer has been thickening in recent years, though, and that's one of the major consequences that we've seen in the Arctic with the warming that we've seen there.
Why is there more carbon in the soil in a boreal forest?
And so carbon has accumulated over hundreds of thousands of years in some places in these ecosystems. So it's a very slow-growing ecosystem, but that also means that decomposition is really slow. So when we're thinking about the carbon cycle, carbon comes into the ecosystem when trees and plants are taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, and then that is transferred below ground into the soil in leaf parts and roots, etc. When there's no decomposition that can put that back into the atmosphere, that carbon is going to accumulate in the soil over time. And so in these high latitude ecosystems where it's really cold and very dark a lot of the time, what you're going to see is the accumulation of that carbon that's coming into the soil year after year. And a lot of it is now locked away as permafrost.
You're studying wildfires in Alaska, both as a Kendall Science Fellow here at UCS and also at Woods Hole Research Center. Tell me a little bit about that.
Wildfires are a natural occurrence in Alaska, even before the onset of climate change. A lot of them in the boreal forest specifically are started by lightning. So a lightning strike will ignite a fire in one of these forests. And because it's typically during the summer, when things maybe have dried out, that fire can spread very quickly. And so in Alaska, compared to other states that we see in the lower 48, they often have the highest acreage of burned area of any state. This year, they've already passed 1 million acres, and we're really only partway through the fire season at this point. So it's a big part of the Alaskan ecosystem, and it's a natural part too. These are fire-adapted ecosystems, so they're used to having fire come through. But as the climate has continued to change, the fires are coming through more frequently, they're happening more often, and they're often burning deeper and more severely into the organic layer, the active layer that I mentioned before that thaws out.
And that's the part that concerns you.
Correct.
So tell me about that.
The active layer, like all soil, has carbon in it. But in this case, because of the slow decomposition that we talked about earlier, it's got a lot more carbon than other soils. And so it can easily burn. And in some cases, fires that are roaring through the boreal forest can burn down to the mineral soil, which is almost like a chocolate ice cream type texture. So it can take almost all of the organic horizon off of the soil. And that contributes a huge amount of carbon, a huge pulse of carbon with each fire that burns into the atmosphere.
What's happening in Alaska with the recent high temperatures, temperatures up to 90?
Yeah, Alaska's been experiencing a record heat wave. So the highest temperatures in Anchorage and several other cities that have ever been recorded. And this heat wave is consistent with the climatic warming that we've seen across the state. And while climate and weather are different, they can be symptomatic of each other. So in Alaska, we've been seeing record temperatures like those in Anchorage that reach 90 degrees. And one of the complicating factors when I'm thinking about my own work and these high temperatures is that by drying out these ecosystems, they may be increasing the risk of fire, which, as we know, is part of this cycle that starts by releasing heat-trapping gases and furthering climatic warming.
So how are wildfires in Alaska managed? Are they managed differently than in the lower 48?
Yeah, so there's an entire system that's specific to Alaska for fire management. So the state is separated, or categorized, rather, into four different zones that determine how resources and personnel are allocated to fight any fire. So we have fires that are in critical zones that are near population centers or other values at risk, where when a fire starts in one of those regions, it's going to be attacked with a huge amount of resources to really put that fire out as quickly as possible. Where on the other end of the spectrum, you have fires and lands that are in limited areas where they're not necessarily receiving the same amount of resources as a fire in the critical zone might be, because it could be several hundred thousand acres of forest, which, not that that's not worth protecting, but in terms of maintaining the natural ecosystem,
they might just let it burn.
Exactly. I guess the one thing that distinguishes fire management in Alaska from fire management in the lower 48 is that the historic fire management that has created a lot of the problems that we're seeing, especially in California, just doesn't exist. There's no analog in Alaska. We haven't been managing forests and suppressing fires as intensely in Alaska as we have in California. And so I think that's a really important distinction in fire management strategies and history.
So in order to minimize forest fires, so we're not releasing all of this extra carbon into the air, what sorts of strategies would work better in Alaska?
When it comes to fighting fire in Alaska, we can do more with management and implement different types of strategies to manage that fire. But in Alaska, we also need to just be fighting climate change generally. We need to be reducing our emissions of heat-trapping gases like carbon dioxide and methane. Because in Alaska, a lot of those same gases are coming out of the ecosystem when they burn.
I mean, I know that wildfires in the West, there's a lot of forest management, like clearing out the underbrush and those sort of strategies. I imagine Alaska is huge and it's wilderness. It seems like those types of practices wouldn't really be practical.
And I think those are challenges with some of those preventative strategies, regardless of the ecosystem, right? Implementing something like the mechanical thinning, like you're talking about, where you go through and remove some of the understory or some of the dead brush that you have there. One of the challenges with that is you can do that on a large area, but there's no guarantee that then that area is going to burn in the years when that treatment is effective. And so in a state like Alaska, where that's magnified because it's such a huge landscape, although there have been people that have been doing research and testing out some of those treatments, the viability of them at a large scale is pretty low.
Recently, the governor of Alaska has slashed funding for research into ecosystems at the University of Alaska. How is that going to impact the work that really needs to happen?
The University of Alaska collects a lot of important data about how Arctic and boreal ecosystems are changing. And so with the deep cuts like those by the governor recently, that data might not be collected anymore. So these longitudinal data sets that we've collected over years and years may suddenly be capped at 2019. And so there could be huge consequences for our understanding of how these ecosystems, and especially the one that we have domestically in Alaska, is going to be changing as our climate continues to warm. Not to mention that the University of Alaska at Fairbanks is the true, like, leading Arctic research university in the United States. And so to have their budget cut in the way that the governor has is going to be a huge loss to the Arctic research community, both here and abroad.
We'll be back in a minute with the second half of our interview. The Got Science podcast is brought to you by the Union of Concerned Scientists. More at gotsciencepodcast.org. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, PRX, SoundCloud, and all the usual podcast outlets. If you'd like a transcript or links to additional resources from this episode and a full bio of our guest, head over to gotsciencepodcast.org. Please tell your friends, colleagues, family, your local barista about the episodes and topics you like. And if you have a sec, please leave us a review. It's quick and easy. And finally, if you're on Twitter, come talk to us at GotScienceUCS. Now let's get back to our interview. So tell me about some of the research that you've been doing at the Woods Hole Research Center.
What we're trying to understand is if we can use fire management as a strategy to reduce overall emissions from the United States. So like I mentioned, there are huge amounts of these heat-trapping gases that are coming out of these fires as they burn in Alaska, as they burn through that active layer, which even further melts the permafrost, which is, you know, happening all over the world. But my research specifically is trying to understand if we can manage fire differently such that we reduce the amount of those greenhouse gases. And so as an example, in 2004, which was one of the largest fire years on record, the amount of heat-trapping gases that were released from all the fires in Alaska were about equal to the emissions that came from the entire state of Florida burning fossil fuels. So these are a huge contribution to overall atmospheric CO2 and methane concentrations. But unlike some of the other challenges in Alaska, like melting permafrost, we actually know how to fight wildfire. And so for us, it presents an opportunity that's more viable than some of those other strategies for reducing emissions.
How do you do the research? Are you on the ground or do you just use computer data?
Yeah, so for the research that I'm doing, we're using a lot of big data sets that are compiled by different government agencies. So we're using a combination of on the ground data sets that have been collected almost over the past century. So databases of Alaska fires and what their, you know, spatial extent is. We're using information about fire weather, about vegetation, a lot of which are from satellite data. And so what we're doing is we're trying to build a predictive model that can predict fire size based on things like vegetation, climate, as well as things like elevation. And in our specific research, we're incorporating these fire management zones, the critical to limited zones that determine how a fire is fought.
As temperatures rise, is there the possibility of extending the boreal forest into the tundra area?
Yeah, so there's definitely predicted range expansion of the boreal forest. And while that might be a positive thing in some respects, because we could get greater carbon storage above ground, an issue with that could be that we don't know what those consequences would be for the permafrost. We don't know whether or not that transition of trees growing into areas where typically there have only been these small shrubs and other, you know, prostrate plants, if that would have any impact on the permafrost.
The one thing that I just can't, like, I can't get a visual on is when you say we can manage the fires in Alaska differently.
In Alaska, when we're talking about managing it differently, it's more about suppressing more fires in high carbon areas.
Which I imagine is challenging because if your fire is out in the middle of the wilderness, how do you get people there to put it out?
Yeah, so there are hot shots and smoke jumpers that are a big part of fighting fire in Alaska. So those are the people that are jumping out of planes into some of these burning forests to be the first on the ground to, you know, dig the trenches and make the fire breaks. But there's also a lot of aviation support in Alaska, and so that can really help, as well as hiking. Mm-hmm. So if you can get yourself out there, sometimes that's the best thing that you can, the best way you can get out there.
So before we started taping, you were talking about the topography and what it's like hiking in different parts of Alaska.
A lot of people who visit Denali for the first time thinking it's going to be the same as hiking the Grand Canyon are often surprised by how spongy the floor is. So the forest floor, I mean, and that's usually by virtue of the plant species that grow there and also the moss. So I know when I was walking in tundra, which is a little different than permafrost, I had someone explain it to me as walking on a mosaic of bowling balls and rotten watermelons, and you never knew which you were going to step on. And that can make the hiking itself even more challenging. I've rolled many an ankle walking in the tundra myself.
So tell me about the time you've spent in Alaska doing research. You've been there typically not in the dead of winter, but in the milder climate.
Yes, I'm very much a fair weather Arctic researcher, and that I've really never seen the sunset in the Arctic, if that tells you anything about the times that I've mm-hmm. been there. So I worked at a research station that's funded by the National Science Foundation called Tulig Lake, that's up on the north slope of the Brooks Range, which is above the Arctic Circle. And so I was interested, like you mentioned at the beginning, in soil carbon and what we can do to preserve that carbon, and also what factors are changing the way that carbon is cycled in those ecosystems. So I dug a lot of cold holes.
And so what does that mean?
Exactly what it sounds like.
You're digging a hole
in the active layer. Mm-hmm. And trying to understand what the microbial communities, the bacteria and fungi that are part of that soil, are doing in response to warming temperatures, in response to vegetation changes across these ecosystems that are changing so much more quickly than the rest of the world.
So are you actually taking samples of that and then bringing it back into the lab? And
yeah, so for a lot of that research, we were bringing that soil back into the lab, and in some cases doing measurements in situ, out in the field, you know, lugging equipment with us. But as you can imagine, there's a certain limit to both what you can bring with you and also what's reasonable to measure on the time scale of the summer up there.
Did you find anything particularly surprising in any of your time out there in the field?
Oh, certainly. Almost everything was surprising. To a certain extent. One of the surprising things was that I learned that you can feel permafrost thaw by walking on the tundra. So there are areas, so it's bowling balls and rotten watermelons, but then there are also areas where it's almost like you're on a trampoline, but there's still ground beneath you. There's like a mm-hmm. bounciness to the land, and so I was taught that that was where there was permafrost failure beneath you, and that's why the ground was bouncier. Uh-huh. So that really surprised me. And I also saw a wolverine, and that was incredibly surprising.
Wow, how
it
close.
Nearly ran us off the road.
Wow. Any grizzly bears?
Only from afar. I used to sing loudly so that the bears would hear me. That's what they recommend when you're out in the field alone.
Wow.
A lot of halo, a lot of love on top. Really get a large vocal range there, you know, if you go mm-hmm. through the key changes. Mm-hmm. Beyoncé's greatest hits, typically.
Well, Carly, thanks so much for joining me on the podcast.
Yeah, I hope we can talk more soon.
It's time for a short segment we call Sidelining Science, the latest news from an administration that can't handle the truth. Our Shreya Dervasula has the story.
I'm about to say a phrase so controversial, so upsetting and provocative, that the United States government is running a censorship operation to make sure the word won't get out. This goes all the way to the top. Are you ready? Climate change. I'm sorry if you were shocked. If your only source of news is the federal government, then chances are you haven't heard those words in a long time. While most people in this country understand that climate change is happening and are worried about how it will affect them and want action, the leadership among federal agencies that should be helping to educate and prepare us for a changing climate is basically hoping we'll all forget about it. And they're doing that through censoring employees and the agency's work anytime climate change is mentioned. Here's how this works. Let's say I'm an agency scientist collaborating with other researchers who are affiliated, for example, with the university. When our research gets peer-reviewed and published, my agency will want the world to know what we found. And my research partners over at the university want that too. So my agency and the university will coordinate to send out press releases citing our findings. Maybe the news picks it up, and the general public then knows the result of my cold study. If you're trying to censor references to climate change, which the Trump administration definitely is, then instead of promoting our work, you would bury it. And that's exactly what this administration is doing. For example, at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, study after study of how climate change will affect the way we produce and eat food has come out without any official recognition. For the vast majority of USDA studies, there have been no press releases. This includes an incredibly consequential study done by the USDA along with the University of Washington, on how rice becomes less nutritious as carbon dioxide levels increase. Hundreds of millions of people around the world depend on the calories and nutrition from rice. But because the report discusses growing carbon emissions, the USDA didn't publicize it. They even tried to stop the University of Washington from issuing a press release about the study. I have a lot to say about this. And so do other folks who've been involved in this particular suppression of science. I'll read their quotes. Quote, "Why the hell is the U.S., which is ostensibly the leader in science research, ignoring this? We're working on something that has dire consequences for the entire planet," end quote. That was an anonymous USDA scientist talking to Politico about this study. Another quote, "It was so unusual to have an agency basically say, don't do a press release. We stand for spreading the word about the science we do, especially when it has a potential impact on millions and millions of people," end quote. That was the director of communications for the University of Washington, also speaking to Politico. This pattern isn't only playing out at the USDA, of course. Over at the U.S. Geological Survey, the department issued an incredibly vague press release for a report that was incredibly specific about the effects of sea level rise on the California coastline. If you live in California, you'd probably want to read a study that predicts more than 600,000 people and $150 billion of property will be at risk from floods over the decades to come. But would you bother reading it if the press release described the results, quote, "Coastal modeling research presenting state, federal, and commercial entities with varying storm and sea level rise scenarios to assist with planning for future infrastructure and mitigation needs along the California coast," end quote? Ugh, probably not. And the administration is betting you won't click on the report to learn more. An earlier draft of the press release was changed heavily by administration officials. They stalled for months while they took out anything relevant that you might need to know about what climate change is going to do to your state. Once again, I have a lot to say about this. And once again, I will defer to a federal scientist. This one spoke anonymously with Science Magazine about the USGS study. Quote, "It's been made clear to us that we are not supposed to use climate change in press releases anymore. They will not be authorized," end quote. The administration has gone so far to avoid the words climate change that it denied a State Department intelligence official from submitting congressional testimony on the topic in June. What was so controversial that it couldn't go on the record? Among other statements, the following. Quote, "Absent extensive mitigating factors or events, we see few plausible future scenarios where significant, possibly catastrophic, harm does not arise from the compounded effects of climate change," end quote. I yell that exact sentence at the top of my lungs 12 times before breakfast every day, so I don't see what the problem is. And this official, who has since resigned, was testifying to the House Intelligence Committee on threats to national security from climate change. So what he said makes perfect sense and is 100% true. Say it with me. Climate change. Climate change. Climate change! The Trump administration may think that ignoring it will make it go away, but we know they're sidelining science.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Got Science podcast. Got Science is made possible by the 130,000 members of UCS, and especially our partners for the Earth, the 12,000 supporters who make monthly contributions to stand up for science. Learn more at ucsusa.org/partners. Special thanks to Dr. Carly Phillips. Sidelining Science by Shreya Dravasula. Editing by Omari Spears. Additional editing and music by Brian Middleton. Research and writing by Pamela Wirth and Jiayu Liang. Our executive producer is Rich Hayes, and I'm your host, Colleen McDonald. Come find us on Twitter at GotScienceUCS. Thanks, and see you next time.
This morning, more than 120 million Americans are under heat warnings, watches, or advisories.
Flirting with the 100-degree mark for your feels-like temperature.
Feels like temperature at 101.
Temperatures are expected to climb into the 80s in Alaska today. That's actually a slight dip from the record-breaking 90 degrees in Anchorage and two other cities on the 4th of July.
Welcome to the Got Science podcast. I'm your host, Colleen MacDonald. Summer is here, and that means hot weather and lots of complaints about heat and humidity. Based on today's podcast conversation, we haven't seen anything yet. And stick around after the interview for our new segment, Science for the Win, with Cynthia Duraco. According to European researchers, June 2019 was the hottest month recorded both in Europe and in the entire world, a fact that just makes the July heat here in Boston feel so much more ominous. After the recent heat waves in Europe, in regions that are usually temperate, I have a feeling that extreme temperatures will be the new normal there and on this side of the Atlantic. But this isn't the Gut Feeling podcast. This is the Got Science podcast, and we're here for the data. So I sat down with my colleague, Christy Dahl, a senior climate scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. She's talking to me fresh off the release of her report on extreme heat, which is the consequence of climate change that will affect more people than any other. And just in case that didn't hit you hard enough, the full title of her team's report is Killer Heat in the United States: Climate Choices and a Future of Dangerously Hot Days. As we dive into the details of her team's analysis, Christy and I talk about what climate models are and how they can forecast decades into the future, about the heat index, aka the quote, feels like, unquote, temperature in your weather app, and about the hard questions ahead, like what will happen as more regions more often see conditions so far off the charts that the heat index tool can't even say how hot it feels. And the most important question, what are our chances of stopping this, and what do we have to do now? Christy, thanks for joining me on the Got Science podcast.
Thanks for having me, Colleen.
So you've just finished an analysis looking at extreme heat and climate change. Why did you and your colleagues decide to do this analysis?
Well, for many years, we'd been working on sea level rise. And while sea level rise will affect millions of people over the course of the coming decades, it's also a very coastal problem. It's limited to a really narrow band along the coast. And it's just one of many, many potential impacts of climate change. So as we saw our sea level rise work build, we thought we would like to be engaging people who live away from the coasts as well in places that may not experience something like sea level rise, but will certainly be feeling the effects of climate change. So we turned to extreme heat.
So what data did you use and what was the methodology?
Sure. So we used climate models to try to understand how extreme heat will change in the future. And when scientists use climate models, the best practice is not to just use one model, but to use many. There are dozens of climate models that have been developed all over the world. And what we've done is taken a suite of those. We used 18 of them. And each of those models ran the same experiment. And then we averaged the results from those climate models. So we specifically take the temperature data and the relative humidity data. Those are the two components of what's called the heat index, or the feels-like temperature. And we have daily data from each of those climate models that allowed us to see what the heat index was on any given day between now and the year 2100. And we use that daily data to ask the question, how often would the heat index be above a certain temperature, above 100 degrees Fahrenheit? So for each of those models, we looked at the number of days above those different temperature thresholds we were interested in, and then we averaged that number of days over all those climate models to get sort of a coherent result.
What is a climate model?
You can think of a climate model as a giant computer program
that you have fed information into. And that information includes things like how the oceans circulate, how water exchanges between the oceans and the atmosphere, how ice forms in the Arctic in the winter and recedes in the summer. So essentially, it's all of the physics that we know about our planet. And then you can force those climate models with different questions or scenarios. You can say, okay, climate model, what happens if we increase the amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere from now through the end of the century? And the climate model will give you an answer, right? It will show you at every point on the Earth what the temperature changes, what the humidity changes, how it changes the winds. And so that's how scientists do these experiments to say, what happens if we start decreasing emissions now versus letting them go up and up and up through the end of the century?
Talk to me about the time frame that you covered in the analysis.
So we looked at the period from 1970 through 2000, and we used that as our historical baseline. Then we looked at mid-century and used 30 years centered around the year 2050. And we looked at the end of the 21st century, the last 30 years of this century. The reason we use 30 years is because there's a lot of variability in our climate from year to year. And you can think of things like El Niño, which happens every 3 to 5 years, right? And creates very different conditions on Earth's surface depending on where you are in that cycle, right? So we use a 30-year period to make sure we're getting what we call a climatological average.
And what did you find?
So what we found is that overall for the country, just by mid-century, there's a doubling in the number of days with a heat index above 100. And we also found that there's a tripling in the number of days with a heat index above 105. And we also looked at these off-the-charts kinds of conditions. And this is a really fascinating concept that's not something, to our knowledge, that anyone's looked at before. The heat index was designed to be calculated and to be valid for conditions that we experience on Earth today. The thing is that as climate warms our overall temperatures, we're going to be getting outside of the range that the heat index was designed to calculate. So right now in our country, the only place where we have these conditions that we call off the charts, where we can't reliably calculate a heat index, are in the Sonoran Desert. That's southern Arizona, very southern edge of California. And even there, there are only 2 or 3 of these sorts of days each year historically. But what we found was that by mid-century, about 25% of the country by area would experience these conditions at least once a year.
Let's talk about the heat index for a minute. You said the feels like temperature, and that's often you hear in a weather report, it's going to feel like X. Tell me what exactly the heat index is.
Sure. So the heat index is a combination of temperature and relative humidity. And you can think of it this way. If you were in your car sitting in Arizona and the dashboard temperature on your car was 90 degrees, when you stepped out of the car, you would feel one thing in Arizona. But if you drove your car to, say, South Carolina, and the dashboard temperature said 90 degrees, when you stepped out, it would likely feel very much hotter, right? Because South Carolina tends to be a much more humid place. So our bodies don't just experience temperature. They experience this combination of temperature and humidity. When the humidity is high, the temperature feels much hotter.
So what's happening to the human body? Why does that happen?
A lot of things happen to the human body as the heat index goes up. As temperature increases, our hearts have to pump blood faster, and we start to pull water away from the core of our body and toward the skin. And that's why your skin becomes flushed when it's hotter. But as that happens, there's a risk of dehydration. There's a risk of your organs, like your kidneys, not having enough fluid to function properly. So all of those changes are happening physiologically in your body as the heat index rises. And the important part about humidity and how it factors into our experience of heat is that when it's very humid outside and there's a lot of water vapor in the air, it's actually harder for your body to cool itself by sweating because it's the evaporation of that sweat that cools you off. When it's more humid, that evaporation is harder.
So ideally, in a humid area where you're sweating and cooling your body, you're replenishing by drinking water, you're replenishing yourself.
Absolutely.
But in this extreme heat, your body can't release its own water, so you're just heating up inside, essentially.
You're just heating up, that's right. And rehydrating is incredibly important, and it's one of the reasons why children are more vulnerable when there's extreme heat, because they often don't recognize that need to rehydrate, and so they tend to become dehydrated more quickly.
We'll be back in a minute with the second half of our interview. The Got Science podcast is brought to you by the Union of Concerned Scientists. More at gotsciencepodcast.org. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, PRX, SoundCloud, and many more places where you can download podcasts. If you'd like a transcript or links to additional resources from this episode and a full bio of our guest, head over to gotsciencepodcast.org. If you want to get directly to the analysis, go to ucsusa.org/killerheat. We'll be doing a follow-up podcast in Spanish and English, looking at the people and communities most affected by extreme heat. So look for that later in the summer. Now, let's get back to our interview. How disruptive will this extreme heat be for people that are living in the hardest hit regions?
There are a couple of different ways to think about which regions will be hardest hit by changes in extreme heat. You could argue that it would be places like the south of Florida. So right now, Orlando, Florida experiences about 20 days with a heat index above 100. So that's about 3 weeks. If we look to mid-century, depending on what scenario we look at, in Orlando, they could be experiencing between 87 and 107 days with a heat index above 100. And if we look at late century in Orlando, the end of the century, they could see over 140 days per year with a heat index above 100. And some of those days would be even hotter. So there'd be about 110 days where the heat index would be above 105, and about 15 days that would have off-the-charts conditions where we can't even really calculate a heat index.
So this is, many people in Florida have air conditioning, but many people don't. And this type of weather sounds dangerous.
It is. It is dangerous. And the danger of this type of heat in Florida was really highlighted in the wake of Hurricane Irma in 2017. So Irma came up the Florida Peninsula from south to north and caused widespread power outages for thousands of people. Without the air conditioning, there were about 12 residents of a nursing home who died because of extreme heat. So it wasn't the storm itself that caused it, but the lack of air conditioning and the heat wave that followed. And that happened with a heat index that hovered right around 100 degrees for a couple of days. So some of the heat we're talking about is even more extreme than that.
But we're also, for people who work outside, who just don't have access to air conditioning, but I'm imagining landscapers,
construction workers, farm workers, yes.
Exactly.
We all rely on a huge group of people in this country who do work outside in conditions where they can't have air conditioning.
So they either lose work or they potentially lose their health.
And that's one of the big problems with trying to understand the impact of extreme heat on outdoor workers. So if you think of a migrant farm worker, for example, that person may be getting paid by the pound or by the bushel. And if they don't have the opportunity to pick or harvest, then they're not getting paid. And so there is a disincentive to reporting that you're feeling uncomfortable due to heat. There's a disincentive for taking the breaks that you need in order to rehydrate, to sit in the shade. So we know that incidences of heat-related illness in outdoor workers, particularly in the agriculture sector, are underreported.
So what areas of the United States will be hardest hit?
In terms of the absolute number of extremely high heat index days, it's places that you wouldn't find surprising, right? The southern parts of Texas, Florida, the deep Gulf Coast states, Louisiana, Mississippi. But then there are places like New England, right, where the absolute number of days that they'll be experiencing of extreme heat in the future is much lower than a place like Texas. But the people who live there are much less accustomed to it, and the infrastructure isn't designed for it. So in Texas, most buildings, most homes are air conditioned. That's not necessarily the case in New England. Or in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I live, nobody has air conditioning. No schools are air conditioned. And so when an extreme heat event hits in these kinds of places, it has an outsized impact.
Well, also, if you then have to air condition a lot more places, then you're not exactly reducing emissions.
Right. The solution here can't be simply add air conditioning, because that's extremely energy intensive. And we know that it's at these times when our energy demand is the greatest that the energy we're getting is the dirtiest, because we have to turn on additional power plants that are typically burning coal. So we know that any response that we design for adapting to a future of extreme heat has to be coupled with one that is addressing clean energy infrastructure.
So these extreme heat days that are above the current heat index chart, we don't even have a name for that. Will a new chart be developed, or will the heat index be expanded?
That's a great question.
Have you come up with any good names for this new?
Believe me, we've thought of all sorts of names. And it's a challenge to even describe what these days are like. And given that so few people in the United States experience these conditions today, it's hard to know what they even imply for us in terms of human health. I think the question of how we handle the fact that we can't calculate a heat index is an interesting one. And I think one that we can surmount, right? We can figure out other ways to describe the feeling of this heat. And some of them may be mathematical. There may be other measures that combine heat and humidity that don't have this upper limit like the heat index does. But I think it also raises this interesting question of how we communicate that risk to the public. So right now, the National Weather Service issues heat advisories and excessive heat warnings that alert people to the fact that there are unsafe conditions outside. Typically, when the heat index is expected to be above 100, they issue a heat advisory. And that'll say things like, make sure you're drinking water, don't leave pets and children in parked cars, children and elderly are particularly at risk, check in on your neighbors, things like that. And at 105 heat index, they'll issue an excessive heat warning, which communicates that this is a risk not just for those sensitive groups, but for everyone. But how do we start to communicate when conditions surpass that, right? And how will the National Weather Service take that on and say, okay, this is heat that's a different category, right? And interestingly, we've heard from many local National Weather Service offices that they're concerned about issuing too many heat warnings because people get desensitized to it and they don't take it as seriously. So given that that's the case, you know, we need to make sure that we're designing systems that really communicate the risk to people of these off the charts, extremely hazardous days.
Is there anything we can do?
There's a lot that we can do here. And one of the most exciting things about our analysis is that it points to the incredible impact that emissions reductions can have, not just in the long term, at the late century timeframe, but even in the mid-century timeframe. we looked at two different emissions scenarios. A higher emissions scenario, where it's our heat-trapping gases continue to rise in kind of a business as usual, no change, through the end of the century. We also looked at a lower emissions scenario, where we aim to cap future global warming to less than 2 degrees above the pre-industrial levels. So it's important to note we already have undergone about a degree of that warming. We don't have a whole lot left until we hit that 2 degree mark. And it would require really substantial, fast, dramatic reductions in our greenhouse gas emissions. But when we look at the difference between those two scenarios, it's incredible. By late century, if we manage to cap warming to less than 2 degrees C, we see about half the number of these extremely hot days than we would see with that business as usual scenario. So by rapidly reducing our emissions, we can hold the line, right? We'll still see increases in the number of extremely hot days. There will still be really widespread extreme heat, but we could prevent it from getting a lot worse.
Do you think it's realistic that we can reduce emissions in that way, that rapidly?
That's a great question, and I wish that I had an optimistic answer for you. I think different people have different takes on this. You know, we know that we have a lot of the technology we need, and we know that the problem at this point is largely one of will and politics, particularly in the U.S. So some people look at that problem and say, well, it's just a problem of politics. We can fix that. You know, it's not like a problem that we can't fix, like the sun is getting hotter, right? There's not much we could do about right. that. We can do something about this. But it is a problem that has been intractable for decades in the U.S. And so while we see really encouraging signs, like the fact that Congress is now discussing climate change at all, like the fact that in states like California and New Mexico, we've passed really inspiring laws that put us on a path to 100% clean energy by the mid-century timeframe. They're encouraging signs, but we need so much more. Many of the impacts of climate change would persist for a long time, even if we stopped emitting greenhouse gases today. Something like sea level rise has a certain amount baked into the system. But that's much less the case with extreme heat. And the actions that we take today will truly be felt by the children who will become adults in mid-century. So what we do today will have a relatively quick impact on the future of extreme heat. So what that means is that we need to pull together the energy that we already have in this country, and we need to be insisting that our leaders take this on at the federal level to make sure that it's a priority.
So if the clean energy momentum that we're seeing already continues, we really have a fighting chance of curbing this.
We do. And if you think about the progress that we made during the Obama administration toward strengthening fuel economy standards, towards incentivizing clean energy, if we can keep things like that going with the next administration, it will give us the best chance we have.
Well, Christy, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks, Colleen. It was great to be with you.
And now it's time for the second installment of our new segment, Science for the Win. Cynthia, take it away.
Thanks, Colleen. One thing I've learned from working on climate change is that it's important to appreciate incremental progress. Would I absolutely love it if tomorrow all cars were electric and all energy were clean? Of course I would. But it's worth celebrating the small wins, because they add up and they lead to bigger wins. So when I say, hooray, the California Air Resources Board just passed a standard that will replace all fossil fuel burning airport shuttle buses with zero emission battery and fuel cell electric vehicles by 2035, I really mean it. Hooray! California is huge, and it has 13 major airports, including the second busiest in the country, LAX. This standard covers nearly 1,000 shuttles across all 13 of those airports. Transitioning these buses to zero-emission technologies by 2035 will reduce global warming emissions by the equivalent of taking almost 7,500 of today's cars off the road each year.
and California is projected to save a net $30 million due to lower maintenance and fuel for these vehicles from 2020 to 2040. So the standard is good news on its own. It's really good news when taken with another standard passed last year that requires all public transit buses to be zero emission. And the best news is that these small wins can add up to an even bigger win. Because these policies for electric public transit buses and airport shuttles could pave the way for electric delivery trucks, electric 18-wheelers, and electric garbage trucks. Transportation is the biggest source of global warming emissions in the U.S. and in California. But it doesn't have to be, because many of these heavy-duty vehicles are perfect for electrification, especially those driving around cities. As my most excellent colleague and senior vehicles analyst Jimmy O'Day says, shuttle buses and smaller-sized delivery trucks have the same business in front, just different parties in the back. So electrifying shuttle buses will expand the market for all electric trucks. This is a win for science, and for the Union of Concerned Scientists, too. Because my colleagues in California, like Jimmy, have been working hard to show the technical feasibility of electrification for vehicles like these. And spending time in meetings and legislators' offices advocating for this switch. California and its Air Resources Board are in the process of setting more standards for manufacturers and buyers of electric trucks and buses, so that more and more of these large vehicles will be zero emissions. I assume we'll have more to celebrate soon. Another facet of this win that could have much broader reverberations beyond its scope is the special nature of California itself. Policies that are tested out and implemented in California are sometimes adopted, sometimes quietly, sometimes with much fanfare, in other states and even nationwide. So it's possible that other states on the West Coast and even miles away are watching this rollout and getting ready to implement these measures themselves. And that would do a lot to lower transportation emissions. In the meantime, hooray for electric airport shuttle buses in California. Incremental progress is definitely still progress. I'm Cynthia DiRocco, and this has been Science for the Win.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Got Science podcast. Got Science is made possible by the 130,000 members of UCS, and especially our partners for the Earth, the 12,000 supporters who make monthly contributions to stand up for science. Learn more at ucsusa.org/partners. Special thanks to Dr. Christy Dahl. Science for the Win with Cynthia DiRocco. Editing and music by Brian Middleton. Research and writing by Pamela Wirth and Jiayu Liang. Our executive producer is Rich Hayes, and I'm your host, Colleen MacDonald. And now, a shameless plug. I'm doing a push to promote the Got Science podcast, so please tell your friends, colleagues, family, your local barista about the episodes and topics you like. And if you have a sec, please leave us a review. It's quick and easy. Just click on My Library in your podcast app and scroll down to the bottom of the list to ratings and reviews. And finally, if you're on Twitter, come talk to us at GotScienceUCS. Thanks, and see you next time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. At 10 o'clock, Madness Radio talks to Arnold Mindel, founder of Process-Oriented Psychology, about his more than 40 years of work and the ancient belief in a purposeful dreaming reality behind everyday events. But first, this from KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Project Northwest's third show on Saturday, August 10th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge in Portland. Project Northwest is a local zine that helps promote hip-hop and R&B artists who are local to the Pacific Northwest, with an emphasis on showcasing artists who are Black and POC, LGBTQIA+, women, and artists who experience disabilities. Their upcoming showcase features Timi Hendrix, Zenith, Charlie Fairfax, and Kayla J. Again, that's Project Northwest's third show on Saturday, August 10th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBO Portland. Right now, coming up at 10 o'clock is Madness Radio. Madness Radio talks to Arnold Mindel, founder of Process Oriented Psychology, about his more than 40 years of work in the ancient belief and purposeful dreaming reality behind everyday events. And don't forget, all of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use your mobile app and click on donate. Hope everyone is having a great Friday morning and setting up for a great weekend. All right. So again, if you're just tuning in at 10 o'clock, it will be Madness Radio talks to Arnold Mindel, founder of Process Oriented Psychology, about his more than 40 years of work and the ancient belief in a purposeful dreaming reality behind everyday events. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and this is Claire.
And Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is streaming, podcasting, and archived at madnessradio.net. Welcome to our new broadcast station, KBOO, in Portland, Oregon. Thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio. I'm your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Dr. Arnold Mindel. He is a Jungian therapist with 40 years experience working with individuals, couples, families, organizations, and large groups, and he has also done conflict resolution work in war zones. Dr. Mindel is the founder of Process-Oriented Psychology and has extensive experience working with people diagnosed with schizophrenia, bipolar, psychosis, and extreme states of consciousness. He is the author of more than a dozen books translated into many languages, and his new book is called Process Mind, A User's Guide to Connecting with the Mind of God. So welcome to Madness Radio, Dr. Arnold Mindel.
Thank you. Thank you, Will. It's a pleasure to be with you and to connect with you and all your guests.
I'm very interested in having you on the show, Arnie, because you have developed a very innovative and creative approach to working with states of madness that came out of Jungian psychology, that you were studied as a Jungian therapist, but then you went on to develop your own approach called process-oriented psychology, which I'm very interested in. I'm actually a student of that here in Portland, Oregon. But what people may not know also is that you actually began your work as a physicist studying in Switzerland, and then you got interested in Jungian psychology. Tell us about how you made that transition from studying physics to going into the world of psychotherapy.